Welcome to the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa, a spiritual community that promotes global transformation through personal transformation. At the center, we are motivated by a compelling vision of a healthy, loving world, which we call the Global Heart Vision. This vision inspires us to bring the gifts of compassion and loving kindness to the world through our ministries and teaching. What you are about to hear is a recording of a message delivered at the Center for Spiritual Living Santa Rosa. Feel welcomed. Feel at home.
Thank you very much, Mr. Christopher Fritchie and the gentlemen of the band. That's wonderful. Thank you. February is Black History Month, and it is also part of the season for nonviolence. At our Wednesday Night Wisdom series, we're going to be celebrating Black History Month and learning all sorts of wonderful things. I'll remind you about that in the announcements later, because we're giving away a free copy of Anthony Ray Hinton's book this Wednesday evening. So I'll remind you to make a date with us later on. On Sundays, we're going to be benefiting from the wisdom of Mahatma Gandhi, who really was a formative part of the whole nonviolent movement. When Gandhi was asked to summarize his entire life's message in three words, he laughed and he quoted from the Hindu scriptures, the Upanishads, and he said these words, "Renounce and enjoy." It kind of reminds me of that wartime poster, "Keep calm and carry on." That's the sort of idea behind the idea of renounce and enjoy. He was referring to an idea which is a reminder to us that in order to be present for the flow of life, we may have to hold things lightly. When we hold onto things too tightly, it can make for complications. Have you noticed? Nobody. Well, here's another way of saying it. We can become prisoners when we attach ourselves to something in an unhealthy, clinging way. You know, when we try to control something, it can sometimes end up controlling us. That's the prison. Maybe you've already found that you've got places in your life where you have experienced that kind of imprisonment. If you've ever been attached to, a person, a situation, a possession, an outcome, in an unhealthy way. And you know, when you are imprisoned by that kind of attachment, then you can't do what Gandhi was suggesting, enjoy. You can't enjoy. Can't even really be effective, because you can't fully be you. Well, that's the easy part to understand. The challenging part to understand was how to not be attached. How exactly do we renounce, surrender our attachments without becoming uncaring? How do we disconnect from all the issues that are facing us in the world today without becoming superficial, shallow, you know, with a bland, everything's good approach to life, to justice, to politics, to love, to raising children, to violence in school, to water quality, to war? How do we detach? Well, Gandhi suggested that the answer is in where our focus lands. And rather than focusing or becoming attached to a specific outcome, he suggested instead that we focus and land on what is ours to do. And then, before we do what is ours to do, check our motive through the filter of our pure intention. and then do the best we can do with what is before us to do. In his words, by detachment, I mean you must not worry whether the desired result follows from your actions or not. So long as your motive is pure, your means correct, really it means that things will come right in the end if you take care of the means and leave the rest to God. Wow. Well, there's an important clue in that statement. So long as your motives are pure. Okay. To get honest with myself. You know, what is it I'm going after? Check my motives through the filter of pure intention. What is in my heart to create through this thing I'm embroiled in? Well, as I've been reading about Gandhi, I've been noticing some similarities between his teachings and our founder Ernest Holmes' teachings. You know, both of them believed in a friendly, open study of other teachings. And both of them believed in incorporating everything that we learn into an authentic life so that it's not just book learning, but it moves into our being. Both of them studied everything that they could lay their hands on in the spirit of open inquiry and welcoming without any fear of learning, without any fear of different ideas, without any fear of contradicting ideas. And both of them believed that studying in this way wouldn't diminish a person's faith but would enhance it. And both of them saw that all teachings have some truth in it, and that the truth appears in many different forms and in different ways to different people. And for both of them, their exposure to the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scripture, radically impacted their thinking. Who knew? Now, with this open attitude to life, Gandhi led a whole nation into freedom, and he became one of the most prominent spiritual, social influences in a century that has become known as one of the most violent centuries in recent history. And his life demonstrated something that we attempt to teach here at the Center for Spiritual Living in our Science of Mind classes, and it's this, that you and I, we can become change agents in this world. And once we decide to make a change, then we must become the change. How? Get honest with myself. Check my motives through the filter of pure intention. Do the best with what I have before me to do. Be engaged authentically and hold the outcome lightly. For Gandhi, one of his defining moments took place when he was in South Africa, where he was working as an attorney. And one day he had to catch a train to do a law job in another city. And at that time, South Africa was a country divided strictly along race lines. You know, people of European descent rode on first-class carriages. Everybody else was expected to ride in the lesser class carriages. Now, Gandhi was issued a first class ticket by his employers to go to do this job. And he traveled alone for most of the way until he reached the high mountain town of Maritzburg in the evening, in the winter. And a white passenger entered the compartment. And upon seeing this dark-complexioned man, the passenger called the officials from the railway to complain. So eventually the officials got on the train and said to Gandhi, "You'll have to leave." And Gandhi said, "I have a ticket." The official said, "That doesn't matter. Leave or I will call the police." Gandhi said, "You may, but I have the right to stay here, and I refuse to get out voluntarily. Well, he was put out of the train by force, and he was left to spend the wintry night in this deserted station in the bitter cold. And sitting there in it, something was born in him. And he called that moment in that cold night in Maritzburg the most creative incident in my life. Out of it emerged his nonviolent approach to social change, an approach that would eventually become the inspiration for millions of people and generations of people in different nations around the world. Gandhi famously said, "I object to violence because when it appears to do good, the good is only temporary. The evil it does is permanent." Let's look at the word nonviolence. It comes from a Sanskrit word, ahimsa, which is made up of two words, ah and hims. Hims means the desire to kill. And ah is the negating prefix, which indicates the absence of. So ahimsa means the absence of the desire to kill. Lacking any desire to kill. Gandhi further said on the subject, "I do not believe in short, violent cuts to success. However much I may sympathize with and admire worthy motives, I am an uncompromising opponent of violent methods, even to serve the most noblest of causes." And he went on to say, "Experience convinces me that permanent good can never be the outcome of untruth and violence. Peace does not come through violence. Harmony does not come through shaming others. Agreement does not come through rigid thinking, black and white thinking. Inclusion does not come from separation thinking," and so it goes. It reminds me of the New Thought teacher, Emma Curtis Hopkins, who said it in a new way. "If the truth makes free when it is told, and we are not free, then the truth has not been told." Oh dear. That night on the train station in Maritzburg for Gandhi, that night saw the birth of a civil disobedience movement. In South Africa, it was born. And instead of fanning the flames of hatred with more hatred, fanning violence with more violence, Gandhi encouraged a style of resistance that demands the highest courage and commitment, a non-violent resistance, or a non-reactive resistance, and it's known as non-resistance. It's kind of complicated to get the idea. I think I can explain it in the form of my acquaintance who has a cat, had a cat, and the cat became overweight. And they took the cat to the vet, and the vet said, "You've got to walk the cat on a leash." Was they live in an apartment, and he said, "You got to put the leash, the harness on the cat, and you got to take the cat out to walk. This is very important for the cat's health." Well, so they got the leash, and they put the leash and the harness on the cat, and the cat just went, boom. It just went limp, completely. It was incredible. The cat didn't fight, it didn't hiss, didn't attack, but it was very clear. It was not in agreement. The cat's non-resistance was not violent, but it was not compliant. Another solution had to be negotiated. Now, as a result of Gandhi's non-reactive resistance, the laws in South Africa in 1914 changed. The ones that were most offensive to Indian nationals, they were repealed, and civil rights started to become a broader part of South African law, although there was still a lot of discrimination based on race and indigenous people. Even so, a small seed of freedom and justice had been planted that would grow eventually into radical change decades later. Here is Gandhi's formula for civil disobedience. Disobedience to be civil must be sincere, respectful, restrained, never defiant, must be based upon some well-understood principle, must not be capricious, and above all, must have no ill will or hatred behind it. Oh, well, there we go. We've got a formula starting to emerge. Get honest with myself. Check my motives through the filter of pure intention. Focus on what is mine to do and do the best I can do with what is before me to do without any hatred, fear, or insincerity. Okay. Nonviolence and non-resistance are connected, and they're not a passive attitude towards life. They require courage and mindfulness and clarity. I get that because I see that I waste a lot of energy, mental, emotional, physical, when I am resistant to something. Don't you? You know, especially if I'm getting bothered. Do you need examples? You know, I don't want things to go this way. Obviously, this subject is wrong. Why can't other people understand? Why did she speak to me like that, and what does it mean? What do they want from me? Why is this so difficult, etc.? So I've been practicing all week, looking for another formula. And the first step is to notice the effects of resistance. Shoulders tense, mind dark, lips pursed, blood temperature rising. Second step is to pause and breathe and relax the shoulders. And then number three, talk to myself. I care about who I am at this moment. I care about how I'm showing up in this moment. I care about how much love I'm birthing into the world at this moment. I care about being as transparent as possible with having as little hidden as possible at this moment. And this is the way in which I begin to detach myself from the resistance. And then I can reconnect with love inside of me and then act from that. In the Bhagavad Gita, which was Gandhi's favorite handbook, his reference for life, detachment is described as skillfulness in action. And it suggests that a detached person focuses on doing her best in whatever she is engaged in. Similar to how Don Miguel Ruiz in The Four Agreements suggests that we be impeccable with our words. Don't take anything personally. Don't assume a thing. And do the best you can with what is yours to do in every moment as it is possible. This is helpful for me. Because right now, there are many things I'm busy with that I'm worried about. I'm worried about the outcomes. I'm worried I'll make the wrong decisions. I'm worried things won't work out right. Do you know that state of mind? You know? And do you know that worry thinking is a form of resistance? The author of the Winnie the Pooh, Melny, Alan Alexander, I think it was. Anyway, he gave us these lovely words. Have you ever stopped to think and then forgot to start again? I mention it because often it's the opposite for me. I stop to think and then I think. And then I think some more. And then I think and think and think. And then the think becomes worry. And very soon I'm a prisoner of my own resistance. Do you know what I mean? Oh, let's find the formula. Number one, notice the effects of the resistance. Remember, shoulders up, dark, hot thinking, lips pursed. Number two, pause, breathe, and drop the shoulders. Number three, begin to talk to myself. I care about who I am and how I'm showing up in this moment. Number four, then do the best I'm capable of doing with whatever I am doing. And number five, try my very best to keep my focus landed in spirit. The Lord of love within, divine mind, or if you prefer, your highest value. You know, when I first read about the idea of non-resistance, I resisted it. Because my mind was screaming at me, what do you mean? Don't you know that people everywhere are being oppressed? You know how the mind is. And I had to remind myself at the time that the great role models of non-resistance, they weren't passive. They moved mountains. Jesus of Nazareth. You know, he spoke to an angry crowd gathering to stone a woman to death. And he stood up and said something, and he turned an angry mob energy into peace. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose legacy encompasses influential decisions in our nation, monumental social actions, major progress in human rights. Mahatma Gandhi liberated a nation. Now, I mentioned the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, because it influenced Mahatma Gandhi and our own founder, Ernest Holmes, very profoundly. Let me tell you a little bit about this scripture, the Gita. It's the story of the morning of a great battle where two armies are gathered. They are facing off for a battle to begin. One side, the army, imagine you're on one side, and here's the other side, the other army, and they are ready to begin the battle. And the prince of one of the houses, say this side, asks his chariot driver to drive him between the two armies down the middle to have a look, to see what's going on. And when the prince does that drive through, he is devastated because he sees on this side and that side family members. On this side and that side, childhood friends. On this side and that side, noble people, good people. And immediately we see that the story is a metaphor for our times. Our nation divided down the middle. Friends, neighbors, loved ones on opposite sides and some in the middle. Who among you have relatives who are going to vote differently to you? And who among you have friends who believe in different solutions than the solutions you believe in? And who among you belong to a group like the Center for Spiritual Living, or a family, or some other group, where you have to hold your opinions close to your heart because they don't fit in? That's what the prince was facing. And it caused him to be filled with despair. And he said, you know, there's no point to this. I can't do this. There's no way to win this. It's just filling me with so much grief. And he fell back into his seat on the chariot and he made a decision to do nothing. And it turns out that his chariot driver is the embodiment of God. And they have a conversation in which God instructs the prince and says that to take no action is an action in itself. And it is an action that carries devastating consequences. And it is better, he says, for the prince to fix his mind on God and then to do what is his to do without anger, violence, or hatred. Now, the metaphor, of course, is about the inner battle in us, the inner despair we feel when we can't see the light because of the darkness. It's not an invitation to war, but it's an invitation to step forward with dignity and courage, to keep my mind on Spirit, the Lord of love within, get honest with myself, check my motives through the filter of pure intention, and then do the best I know how to do with what is before me. For our meditation time, I thought I'd read to you a passage from the end of chapter 2 of the Gita as a tribute to the inspiration that Gandhi felt from it and then translated into the world. I invite you to breathe in. And as you exhale, let your eyes close and let these words settle in your heart. They live in wisdom who see themselves in all and all in them. They live in wisdom whose love for the Lord of love has consumed every selfish desire, tormenting the heart. Not agitated by grief nor hankering after pleasure, they live free from fear and anger and craving. Chained no more by selfish attachments, they are not elated by good fortune nor depressed by bad. Such are holy people. When you persistently think about sense objects, that's when attachment comes. And attachment breeds desire, the longing for possession. And when that desire is not fulfilled, it burns to anger. And anger clouds the judgment, and that robs you of the power to learn from past mistakes. And then lost is the discriminative faculty, and your life may become wasted. But when you move through the world of sensory information, free from both attachment and aversion, there comes a peace in which all sorrow ends, and you live in the wisdom of the self within. When you let your mind follow the alluring call of the senses, it carries away your better judgment, just as a storm wind drives a boat off the charted course into doom. But they are forever free who have broken out of the ego cage of I and mine, so that they may be united with the Lord of love within. And this union is the supreme state. I invite you to let the next breath you take be deeper than the one before, followed by a sigh. as we bring this moment of contemplation to an end and make the transition to the part of our service where we support our center through the practice of circulation. I invite the ushers to stand. And won't you please take your gift in your hand, or if you gave electronically, you may place your hand on your chest as a symbol of your heart connection to your support of your Center for Spiritual Living, thinking about the good it is doing in the world through you. And I invite you to say after me, I bless this gift. I send it forth to heal and prosper. It does amazing work in the world. And so it is. Ushers, please receive the gift.